He's just saying things because he wants a big tip, Brightness. I've heard that story, but I think it's blustering ridiculous. If the winds blew strong enough to move bells, then people would notice. Besides, people didn't notice it was raining on their blustering heads.
Shallan smiled. It's all right. He can continue. The porter chatted on in his clipped voice. What language was that, anyway? Shallan listened to Yalb's translation, drinking in the sights, sounds, and, unfortunately, scents. She'd grown up accustomed to the crisp smell of freshly dusted furniture and flatbread baking in the kitchens. Her ocean journey had taught her new scents of brine and clean sea air. There was nothing clean in what she smelled here. Each passing alleyway had its own unique array of revolting stenches. These alternated with the spicy scents of street vendors and their foods, and the juxtaposition was even more nauseating. Fortunately, her porter moved into the central part of the roadway, and the stenches abated, although it did slow them as they had to contend with thicker traffic. She gawked at those they passed. Those men with gloved hands and faintly bluish skin were from Natanatan. But who were those tall, stately people dressed in robes of black, and the men with their beards bound in cords making them rod-like? The sounds put Shallan in mind of the competing choruses of wild songlings near her home, only multiplied in variety and volume. 100 voices called to one another, mingling with doors slamming, wheels rolling on stone, occasional sky eels crying. The ever-present bells tinkled in the background, louder when the wind blew. They were displayed in the windows of shops, hung from rafters. Each lantern pole along the street had a bell hung under the lamp, and her cart had a small silvery one at the very tip of its canopy. When she was about halfway up the hillside, a rolling wave of loud clock bells rang the hour. The varied, unsynchronized chimes made a clangorous din. The crowds thinned as they reached the upper quarter of the city, and eventually her porter pulled her to a massive building at the very apex of the city. Painted white, it was carved from the rock face itself, rather than built of bricks or clay. The pillars out front grew seamlessly from the stone, and the backside of the building melded smoothly into the cliff. The outcroppings of roof had squat domes atop them, and were painted in metallic colors. Light-eyed women passed in and out, carrying scribing utensils and wearing dresses like Shallan's, their left hands properly cuffed. The men entering or leaving the building wore military-style Vorin coats and stiff trousers, buttons up the sides, and ending in a stiff collar that wrapped the entire neck. Many carried swords at their waists, the belts wrapping around the knee-length coats. The porter stopped and made a comment to Yalb. The sailor began arguing with him, hands on hips. Shallan smiled at his stern expression, and she blinked pointedly, affixing the scene in her memory for later sketching.
"He's offering to split the difference with me if I let him inflate the price of the trip," Yalb said, shaking his head and offering a hand to help Shallan from the cart.
She stepped down, looking at the porter, who shrugged, smiling like a child who had been caught sneaking sweets. She clutched her satchel with her cuffed arm, searching through it with her free hand for her money pouch.
"How much should I actually give him?"
2 clear chips should be more than enough. I'd have offered 1. The thief wanted to ask for 5.
Before this trip, she'd never used money. She'd just admired the spheres for their beauty. Each one was composed of a glass bead, a little larger than a person's thumbnail, with a much smaller gemstone set at the center. The gemstones could absorb stormlight, and that made the spheres glow. When she opened the money pouch, shards of ruby, emerald, diamond, and sapphire shone out on her face. She fished out 3 diamond chips, the smallest denomination. Emeralds were the most valuable, for they could be used by soul casters to create food. The glass part of most spheres was the same size. The size of the gemstone at the center determined the denomination.
The three chips, for instance, each had only a tiny splinter of diamond inside. Even that was enough to glow with stormlight, far fainter than a lamp, but still visible. A mark, the medium denomination of sphere, was a little less bright than a candle, and it took 5 chips to make a mark. She'd brought only infused spheres, as she'd heard that done ones were considered suspect, and sometimes a moneylender would have to be brought in to judge the authenticity of the gemstone. She kept the most valuable spheres she had in her safe pouch, of course, which was buttoned to the inside of her left sleeve. She handed the 3 chips to Yalb, who cocked his head. She nodded at the porter, blushing, realizing that she'd reflexively used Yalb like a master-servant intermediary. Would he be offended? He laughed and stood up stiffly, as if imitating a master-servant, paying the porter with a mock stern expression. The porter laughed, bowed to Shallan, then pulled his cart away. "This is for you," Shallan said, taking out a ruby mark and handing it to Yalb.
"Brightness, this is too much."
"It's partially out of thanks," she said, "but is also to pay you to stay here and wait for a few hours, in case I return."
"Wait a few hours for a fire mark? That's wages for a week's sailing."
"Then it should be enough to make certain you don't wander off."
"I'll be right here," Yalb said, giving her an elaborate bow that was surprisingly well executed.
Shallan took a deep breath and strode up the steps toward the conclave's imposing entrance. The carved rock really was remarkable. The artist in her wanted to linger and study it, but she didn't dare. Entering the large building was like being swallowed. The hallway inside was lined with stormlight lamps that shone with white light. Diamond bromes were probably set inside them. Most buildings of fine construction used stormlight to provide illumination. A brome, the highest denomination of sphere, glowed with about the same light as several candles. Their light shone evenly and softly on the many attendants, scribes, and light eyes moving through the hallway. The building appeared to be constructed as one broad, high, and long tunnel, burrowed into the rock. Grand chambers lined the sides, and subsidiary corridors branched off the central grand promenade. She felt far more comfortable than she had outdoors. This place, with its bustling servants, its lesser bright lords and bright ladies, was familiar. She raised her free hand in a sign of need, and sure enough a master servant in a crisp white shirt and black trousers hurried over to her.
"Brightness," he asked, speaking her native Vaden, likely because of the color of her hair.
"I seek Yasna Kolin," Shallan said. "I have word that she is within these walls." The master servant bowed crisply. Most master servants prided themselves on their refined service, the very same air that Yalb had been mocking moments ago.
"I shall return, Brightness."
He would be of the second Nan, a dark-eyed citizen of very high rank. In Vorin belief, one's calling, the task to which one dedicated one's life, was of vital importance. Choosing a good profession and working hard at it was the best way to ensure good placement in the afterlife. The specific devotee that one visited for worship often had to do with the nature of one's chosen calling. Shallan folded her arms, waiting. She had thought long about her own calling. The obvious choice was her art, and she did so love sketching. But it was more than just the drawing that attracted her. It was the study, the questions raised by observation. Why weren't the sky eels afraid of people? What did haspers feed on? Why did a rat population thrive in one area but fail in another? So she'd chosen natural history instead. She longed to be a true scholar, to receive real instruction, to spend time on deep research and study. Was that part of why she'd suggested this daring plan of seeking out Yasna and becoming her ward? Perhaps. However, she needed to remain focused. Becoming Yasna's ward, and therefore student, was only one step. She considered this as she idly walked up to a pillar, using her free hand to feel the polished stone. Like much of Roshar, save for certain coastal regions, Carbranth was built on raw, unbroken stone. The buildings outside had been set directly on the rock, and this one sliced into it. The pillar was granite, she guessed, though her geological knowledge was sketchy. The floor was covered with long, burnt-orange rugs. The material was dense, designed to look rich but bear heavy traffic. The broad, rectangular hallway had an old feel to it. One book she'd read claimed that Carbranth had been founded way back into the Shadow Days, years before the last desolation. That would make it old indeed. Thousands of years ago, created before the terrors of the Hierocracy, long before, even, the Recreants. Back when void-bringers with bodies of stone were said to have stalked the land. "Brightness?" a voice asked. Shallan turned to find that the servant had returned. "This way, Brightness." She nodded to the servant, and he led her quickly down the busy hallway. She went over how to present herself to Yasna. The woman was a legend. Even Shallan, living in the remote estates of Yakaved, had heard of the Alethi king's brilliant heretic sister. Yasna was only 34 years old, yet many felt she would already have obtained the cap of a master scholar if it weren't for her vocal denunciations of religion. Most specifically, she denounced the devotaries, the various religious congregations that proper Vorin people joined. Improper quips would not serve Shallan well here. She would have to be proper. Wardship to a woman of great renown was the best way to be schooled in the feminine arts. Music, painting, writing, logic, and science. It was much like how a young man would train in the honor guard of a bright lord he respected. Shallan had originally written to Yasna requesting a wardship in desperation. She hadn't actually expected the woman to reply in the affirmative. When she had, via a letter commanding Shallan to attend her in Dumadari in 2 weeks, Shallan had been shocked. She'd been chasing the woman ever since. Yasna was a heretic. Would she demand that Shallan renounce her faith? She doubted she could do such a thing. Vorin teachings regarding one's glory and calling had been one of her few refuges during the difficult days when her father had been at his worst. They turned into a narrower hallway, entering corridors increasingly far from the main cavern. Finally, the master servant stopped at a corner and gestured for Shallan to continue. There were voices coming from the corridor to the right. Shallan hesitated. Sometimes she wondered how it had come to this. She was the quiet one, the timid one, the youngest of 5 siblings and the only girl, sheltered, protected all her life, and now the hopes of her entire house rested on her shoulders. Their father was dead, and it was vital that remain a secret. She didn't like to think of that day. She all but blocked it from her mind and trained herself to think of other things. But the effects of his loss could not be ignored. He had made many promises, some business deals, some bribes, some of the latter disguised as the former. House Devar owed great amounts of money to a great number of people, and without her father to keep them all appeased, the creditors would soon begin making demands. There was nobody to turn to. Her family, mostly because of her father, was loathed even by its allies. High Prince Valum, the Bright Lord to whom her family gave fealty, was ailing, and no longer offered them the protection he once had. When it became known that her father was dead and her family bankrupt, that would be the end of House Devar. They'd be consumed and subjugated to another house. They'd be worked to the bone as punishment. In fact, they might even face assassination by disgruntled creditors. Preventing that depended on Shallan, and the first step came with Yasna Kolin. Shallan took a deep breath, then strode around the corner.
Four. The Shattered Plains.
I'm dying, aren't I? Healer, why do you take my blood? Who is that beside you with his head of lines? I can see a distant sun, dark and cold, shining in a black sky.
collected on the 3rd of Yesnan, 1172, 11 seconds pre-death. Subject was a Reshi Chul trainer. Sample is of particular note.
"Why don't you cry?"
the Windspren asked. Kaladin sat with his back to the corner of the cage, looking down. The floor planks in front of him were splintered as if someone had dug at them with nothing but his fingernails. The splintered section was stained dark where the dry gray wood had soaked up blood. A futile, delusional attempt at escape. The wagon continued to roll. The same routine each day. Wake up sore and aching from a fitful night spent without mattress or blanket. One wagon at a time, the slaves were let out and hobbled with leg irons and given time to shuffle around and relieve themselves. Then they were packed away and given morning slop, and the wagons rolled until afternoon slop. More rolling, evening slop, than a ladle of water before sleep. Kaladin's shash brand was still cracked and bleeding. At least the cage's top gave shade from the sun. The Windspren shifted to mist, floating like a tiny cloud. She moved in close to Kaladin, the motion outlining her face at the front of the cloud, as if blowing back the fog and revealing something more substantial underneath. Vaporous, feminine, and angular. With such curious eyes, like no other Spren he'd seen.
"The others cry at night," she said. "But you don't."
"Why cry?" he said, leaning his head back against the bars. "What would it change?"
"I don't know. Why do men cry?"
He smiled, closing his eyes. "Ask the Almighty why men cry, little Spren. Not me." His forehead dripped with sweat from the eastern summer humidity, and it stung as it seeped into his wound. Hopefully they'd have some weeks of spring again soon. Weather and seasons were unpredictable. You never knew how long they would go on, though typically each would last a few weeks. The wagon rolled on. After a time, he felt sunlight on his face. He opened his eyes. The sun shone in through the upper side of the cage. 2 or 3 hours past noon, then. What of afternoon slop? Kaladin stood, pulling himself up with one hand on the steel bars. He couldn't make out Tavlakov driving the wagon up ahead, only flat-faced Bluth behind. The mercenary had on a dirty shirt that laced up the front and wore a wide-brimmed hat against the sun, his spear and cudgel riding on the wagon bench beside him. He didn't carry a sword, not even Tavlakov did that. Not near a Lethe land. The grass continued to part for the wagons, vanishing just in front, then creeping out after the wagons passed. The landscape here was dotted with strange shrubs that Kaladin didn't recognize. They had thick stalks and stems and spiny green needles. Whenever the wagons grew too close, the needles pulled into the stalks, leaving behind twisted worm-like trunks with knotted branches. They dotted the hilly landscape, rising from the grass-covered rocks like diminutive sentries. The wagons just kept on going, well past noon. "Why aren't we stopping for slop?" The lead wagon finally pulled to a stop. The other two lurched to a halt behind it. The red carapaced chulls fidgeted, their antennae waving back and forth. The box-shaped animals had bulging, stony shells and thick, trunk-like red legs. From what Kaladin had heard, their claws could snap a man's arm. But chulls were docile, particularly domesticated ones, and he'd never known anyone in the army to get more than a half-hearted pinch from one. Bluth and Tag climbed down from their wagons and walked up to meet Tavlakov. The slave master stood on his wagon's seat, shading his eyes against the white sunlight and holding a sheet of paper in his hand. An argument ensued. Tavlakov kept waving in the direction they had been going, then pointing at his sheet of paper.
"Lost, Tavlakov?" Kaladin called. "Perhaps you should pray to the Almighty for guidance. I hear he has a fondness for slavers.
keeps a special room in Damnation just for you. To Kaladin's left, one of the slaves, the long-bearded man who had talked to him a few days back, sidled away, not wanting to stand close to a person who was provoking the slaver. Tavlokov hesitated, then waved curtly to his mercenaries, silencing them. The portly man hopped down from his wagon and walked over to Kaladin.
You, he said, deserter, let the armies travel these lands for their war. Do you know anything of the area?
Let me see the map, Kaladin said. Tavlokov hesitated, then held it up for Kaladin. Kaladin reached through the bars and snatched the paper. Then, without reading it, Kaladin ripped it in two. In seconds, he'd shredded it into 100 pieces in front of Tavlokov's horrified eyes. Tavlokov called for the mercenaries, but by the time they arrived, Kaladin had a double handful of confetti to toss out at them.
Happy Middlefest, you bastards, Kaladin said as the flakes of paper fluttered around them.
He turned and walked to the other side of the cage and sat down, facing them.
Tavlokov stood, speechless. Then, red-faced, he pointed at Kaladin and hissed something at the mercenaries. Bluth took a step toward the cage, but then thought better of it. He glanced at Tavlokov, then shrugged and walked away. Tavlokov turned to Tag, but the other mercenary just shook his head, saying something soft. After a few minutes of stewing at the cowardly mercenaries, Tavlokov rounded the cage and approached where Kaladin was sitting. Surprisingly, when he spoke, his voice was calm.
I see you are clever, deserter. You have made yourself invaluable. My other slaves, they aren't from this area, and I have never come this way. You can bargain. What is it you wish in exchange for leading us? I can promise you an extra meal each day, should you please me.
You want me to lead the caravan?
Instructions will be acceptable.
All right. First find a cliff.
That, it will give you a vantage to see the area?
No, Kaladin said. It will give me something to throw you off of.
Tavlokov adjusted his cap in annoyance, brushing back one of his long, white eyebrows.
You hate me. That's good. Hatred will keep you strong, make you sell for much. But you will not find vengeance on me unless I have a chance to take you to market. I will not let you escape. But perhaps someone else would. You want to be sold, you see?
I don't want vengeance, Kaladin said.
The windspren came back. She darted off for a time to inspect one of the strange shrubs. She landed in the air and began walking around Tavlokov's face, inspecting him. He didn't seem to be able to see her. Tavlokov frowned.
No vengeance?
It doesn't work, Kaladin said. I learned that lesson long ago.
Long ago? You cannot be older than 18 years, deserter.
It was a good guess. He was 19. Had it really only been 4 years since he'd joined Amaram's army? Kaladin felt as if he'd aged a dozen.
You are young, Tavlokov continued. You could escape this fate of yours. Men have been known to live beyond the slave's brand. You could pay off your slave price, you see. Or convince one of your masters to give you your freedom. You could become a free man again. It is not so unlikely.
Kaladin snorted. I'll never be free of these brands, Tavlokov. You must know that I've tried, and failed, to escape 10 times over. It's more than these glyphs on my head that makes your mercenaries wary.
Past failure does not prove that there is not chance in the future, yes?
I'm finished. I don't care.
He eyed the slaver. Besides, you don't actually believe what you're saying. I doubt a man like you would be able to sleep at night if he thought the slaves he sold would be free to seek him out one day.
Tavlokov laughed.
Perhaps, deserter, Perhaps you are right. Or perhaps I simply think that if you were to get free, you would hunt down the first man who sold you to slavery, you see? High Lord Amaram, was it not? His death would give me warning, so I could run.
How had he known? How had he heard about Amaram? I'll find him, Kaladin thought. I'll gut him with my own hands. I'll twist his head right off his neck. I'll...
Yes, Tavlokov said, studying Kaladin's face. So you were not so honest when you said you do not thirst for vengeance. I see.
How do you know about Amaram? Kaladin said, scowling. I've changed hands a half dozen times since then.
Men talk. Slavers more than most. We must be friends with one another, you see, for nobody else will stomach us.
Then you know that I didn't get this brand for deserting.
Ah, but it is what we must pretend, you see. Men guilty of high crimes, they do not sell so well. With that shash glyph on your head, it will be difficult enough to get a good price for you. If I cannot sell you, then you... Well, you will not wish for that status. So we will play a game together. I will say you are a deserter, and you will say nothing. It is an easy game, I think.
It's illegal.
We are not in Alethkar, Tavlokov said. So there is no law. Besides, desertion was the official reason for your sale. Claim otherwise and you will gain nothing but a reputation for dishonesty.
Nothing besides a headache for you.
But you just said you have no desire for vengeance against me.
I could learn. Tavlokov laughed.
Ah, if you have not learned that already, then you probably never will. Besides, did you not threaten to throw me off a cliff? I think you have learned already. But now we must discuss how to proceed. My map has met with an untimely demise, you see.
Kaladin hesitated, then sighed. I don't know, he said honestly. I've never been this way either. Tavlokov frowned. He leaned closer to the cage, inspecting Kaladin, though he still kept his distance. After a moment, Tavlokov shook his head.
I believe you, deserter. A pity. Well, I shall trust my memory. The map was poorly rendered anyway. I am almost glad you ripped it, for I was tempted to do the same myself. If I should happen across any portraits of my former wives, I shall see that they cross your path and take advantage of your unique talents.
He strolled away. Kaladin watched him go, then cursed to himself. What was that for? The Windspren said, walking up to him, head cocked. I almost find myself liking him, Kaladin said, pounding his head back against the cage. But, after what he did? Kaladin shrugged. I didn't say Tavlokov isn't a bastard. He's just a likable bastard. He hesitated, then grimaced. Those are the worst kind. When you kill them, you end up feeling guilty for it.
The wagon leaked during high storms. That wasn't surprising. Kaladin suspected that Tavlokov had been driven to slaving by ill fortune. He would rather be trading other goods, but something, lack of funds, a need to leave his previous environs with haste, had forced him to pick up this least reputable of careers. Men like him couldn't afford luxury or even quality. They could barely stay ahead of their debts. In this case, that meant wagons which leaked. The boarded sides were strong enough to withstand high storm winds, but they weren't comfortable. Tavlokov had almost missed getting ready for this high storm. Apparently, the map Kaladin had torn up had also included a list of high storm dates purchased from a roving storm warden. The storms could be predicted mathematically. Kaladin's father had made a hobby of it. He'd been able to pick the right day 8 times out of 10. The boards rattled against the cage's bars as wind buffeted the vehicle, shaking it, making it lurch like a clumsy giant's plaything. The wood groaned, and spurts of icy rainwater sprayed through cracks. Flashes of lightning leaked through as well, accompanied by thunder. That was the only light they got. Occasionally, light would flash without the thunder. The slaves would groan in terror at this, thinking about the Stormfather, the shades of the Lost Radiance, or the Voidbringers, all of which were said to haunt the most violent high storms. They huddled together on the far side of the wagon, sharing warmth. Kaladin left them to it, sitting alone with his back to the bars. Kaladin didn't fear stories of things that walked the storms. In the army, he'd been forced to weather a high storm or two beneath the lip of a protective stone overhang or other bit of impromptu shelter. Nobody liked to be out during a storm, but sometimes you couldn't avoid it. The things that walked the storms, perhaps even the Stormfather himself, weren't nearly so deadly as the rocks and branches cast up into the air. In fact, the storm's initial tempest of water and wind, the storm wall, was the most dangerous part. The longer one endured after that, the weaker the storm grew, until the trailing edge was nothing more than sprinkling rain. Now, he wasn't worried about void bringers looking for flesh to feast upon. He was worried that something might happen to Tavlokov. The slave master waded out in the storm in a cramped wooden enclosure built into the bottom of his wagon. That was ostensibly the safest place in the caravan, but an unlucky twist of fate, a tempest-thrown boulder, the collapse of the wagon, could leave him dead. In that case, Kaladin could see Bluth and Tag running off, leaving everyone in their cages, wooden sides locked up. The slaves would die a slow death by starvation and dehydration, baking under the sun in these boxes. The storm continued to blow, shaking the wagon. Those winds felt like live things at times. And who was to say they weren't? Were Windspren attracted to gusts of wind? Or were they the gusts of wind? The souls of the force that now wanted so badly to destroy Kaladin's wagon. That force, sentient or not, failed. The wagons were chained to nearby boulders with their wheels locked. The blasts of wind grew more lethargic. Lightning stopped flashing, and the maddening drumming of rain became a quiet tapping instead. Only once during their journey had a wagon toppled during a high storm. Both it and the slaves inside had survived, with a few dents and bruises. The wooden side to Kaladin's right shook suddenly, then fell open as Bluth undid its clasps. The mercenary wore his leather coat against the wet, streams of water falling from the brim of his hat as he exposed the bars, and the occupants, to the rain. It was cold, though not as piercingly so as during the height of the storm. It sprayed across Kaladin and the huddled slaves. Tavlokov always ordered the wagons uncovered before the rain stopped. He said it was the only way to wash away the slaves' stink. Bluth slid the wooden side into place beneath the wagon, then opened the other two sides. Only the wall at the front of the wagon, just behind the driver's seat, couldn't be brought down. "Little early to be taking down the sides, Bluth," Kaladin said. It wasn't quite the riddens yet, the period near the end of a high storm when the rain sprinkled softly. This rain was still heavy, the wind still gusting on occasion.
"The master wants you plenty clean today."
"Why?" Kaladin asked, rising, water streaming from his ragged brown clothing. Bluth ignored him. Perhaps we're nearing our destination, Kaladin thought as he scanned the landscape. Over the last few days, the hills had given way to uneven rock formations, places where weathering winds had left behind crumbling cliffs and jagged shapes.
Grass grew up the rocky sides that saw the most sun, and other plants were plentiful in the shade. The time right after a high storm was when the land was most alive. Rockbud polyps split and sent out their vines. Other kinds of vine crept from crevices, licking up water. Leaves unfolded from shrubs and trees. Gremlings of all kinds slithered through puddles, enjoying the banquet. Insects buzzed into the air. Larger crustaceans, crabs and leggers, left their hiding places. The very rocks seemed to come to life. Kaladin noted a half-dozen windspren flitting overhead, their translucent forms chasing after, or perhaps cruising along with, the high storm's last gusts. Tiny lights rose around the plants. Lifespren. They looked like motes of glowing green dust, or swarms of tiny translucent insects. A legger, its hair-like spines lifted to the air to give warning of changes in the wind, climbed along the side of the cart, its long body lined with dozens of pairs of legs. That was familiar enough, but he'd never seen a legger with such a deep purple carapace. Where was Tavlokov taking the caravan? Those uncultivated hillsides were perfect for farming. You could spread stump weight sap on them, mixed with lavis seeds, during seasons of weaker storms following the weeping. In 4 months you'd have polyps larger than a man's head growing all along the hill, ready to break open for the grain inside. The chulls lumbered about, feasting on rock buds, slugs, and smaller crustaceans that had appeared after the storm. Tag and Bluth quietly hitched the beasts to their harnesses as a grumpy-looking Tavlokov crawled out of his waterproof refuge. The slave master pulled on a cap and deep black cloak against the rain. He rarely came out until the storm had passed completely. He was very eager to get to their destination. Were they that close to the coast? That was one of the only places where they'd find cities in the unclaimed hills. Within minutes, the wagons were rolling again across the uneven ground. Kaladin settled back as the sky cleared, the high storm a smudge of blackness on the western horizon. The sun brought welcome warmth, and the slaves basked in the light, streams of water dripping from their clothing and running out the back of the rocking wagon. Presently, a translucent ribbon of light zipped up to Kaladin. He was coming to take the Windspren's presence for granted. She had gone out during the storm, but she'd come back, as always. "I saw others of your kind," Kaladin said idly.
"Others?"
she asked, taking the form of a young woman. She began to step around him in the air, spinning occasionally, dancing to some unheard beat. "Windspren," Kaladin said, "chasing after the storm. Are you certain you don't want to go with them?" She glanced westward longingly.
"No,"
she finally said, continuing her dance.
"I like it here."
Kaladin shrugged. She'd ceased playing as many pranks as she once had, and so he'd stopped letting her presence annoy him.
"There are others near," she said. "Others like you."
"Slaves?"
"I don't know. People. Not the ones here. Other ones."
"Where?" She turned a translucent white finger, pointing eastward.
"There. Many of them. Lots and lots."
Kaladin stood up. He couldn't imagine that a Spren had a good handle on how to measure distance and numbers. "Yes," Kaladin squinted, studying the horizon. "That's smoke. From chimneys?" He caught a gust of it on the wind. If not for the rain, he'd probably have smelled it sooner. Should he care? It didn't matter where he was a slave, he'd still be a slave. He'd accepted this life. That was his way now. Don't care, don't bother. Still, he watched with curiosity as his wagon climbed the side of a hill and gave the slaves inside a good vantage of what was ahead. It wasn't a city. It was something grander, something larger. An enormous army encampment. "Great Father of Storms," Kaladin whispered. 10 masses of troops bivouacked in familiar Alethi patterns, circular, by company rank, with camp followers on the outskirts, mercenaries in a ring just inside them, citizen soldiers near the middle, light-eyed officers at the very center. They were camped in a series of enormous crater-like rock formations, only the sides were more irregular, more jagged, like broken eggshells. Kaladin had left an army much like this 8 months ago, though Amaram's force had been much smaller. This one covered miles of stone, stretching far both north and south. 1,000 banners bearing 1,000 different family glyph pairs flapped proudly in the air. There were some tents, mainly on the outside of the armies, but most of the troops were housed in large stone barracks. That meant soul casters. That encampment directly ahead of them flew a banner Kaladin had seen in books. Deep blue with white glyphs. Koch and Linnel, stylized and painted as a sword standing before a crown. House Colon, the king's house. Daunted, Kaladin looked beyond the armies. The landscape to the east was as he'd heard it described in 12 different stories detailing the king's campaign against the Parshendi betrayers. It was an enormous, riven plain of rock, so wide he couldn't see the other side, that was split and cut by sheer chasms, crevasses, 20 or 30 feet wide. They were so deep that they disappeared into darkness and formed a jagged mosaic of uneven plateaus, some large, others tiny. The expansive plain looked like a platter that had been broken, its pieces then reassembled with small gaps between the fragments.
The shattered plains, Kaladin whispered.
What?
The Windspren asked.
What's wrong?
Kaladin shook his head, bemused.
I spent years trying to get to this place. It's what Tien wanted. In the end, at least. To come here, fight in the king's army.
And now Kaladin was here. Finally.
Accidentally.
He felt like laughing at the absurdity.
I should have realized, he thought. I should have known. We weren't ever heading toward the coast and its cities. We were heading here. To war.
This place would be subject to Alethi law and rules. He'd expected that Tevlakov would want to avoid such things. But here, he'd probably also find the best prices.
Shattered plains? One of the slaves said. Really?
Others crowded around, peering out. In their sudden excitement, they seemed to forget their fear of Kaladin.
It is the Shattered Plains, another man said. That's the king's army. Perhaps we'll find justice here, another said. I hear the king's household servants live as well as the finest merchants, said another. His slaves have to be better off, too. We'll be in Boren lands. We'll even make wages.
That much was true. When worked, slaves had to be paid a small wage, half what a non-slave would be paid, which was already often less than a full citizen would make for the same work. But it was something, and Alethi law required it. Only Ardents, who couldn't own anything anyway, didn't have to be paid. Well, them and Parshmen. But Parshmen were more animal than anything else. A slave could apply his earnings to his slave debt, and, after years of labor, earn his freedom. Theoretically. The others continued to chatter as the wagons rolled down the incline. But Kaladin withdrew to the back of the wagon. He suspected that the option to pay off a slave's price was a sham, intended to keep slaves docile. The debt was enormous, far more than a slave sold for, and virtually impossible to earn out. Under previous masters, he'd demanded his wages be given to him. They had always found ways to cheat him, charging him for his housing, his food. That's how light eyes were. Roshon, Amaram, Kararotam. Each light eyes Kaladin had known, whether as a slave or a free man, had shown himself to be corrupt to the core, for all his outward poise and beauty. They were like rotting corpses, clothed in beautiful silk. The other slaves kept talking about the king's army and about justice.
Justice? Kaladin thought, resting his back against the bars. I'm not convinced there is such a thing as justice.
Still, he found himself wondering. That was the king's army, the armies of all 10 high princes, come to fulfill the vengeance pact. If there was one thing he still let himself long for, it was the chance to hold a spear, to fight again, to try and find his way back to the man he had been, a man who had cared. If he would find that anywhere, he'd find it here.
Five. Heretic. I have seen the end, and have heard it named. The Night of Sorrows, the True Desolation, the Everstorm. Collected on the first of Nannies, 1172, 15 seconds pre-death. Subject was a dark-eyed youth of unknown origin. Shallan had not expected Yasna Kolin to be so beautiful. It was a stately, mature beauty, as one might find in the portrait of some historical scholar. Shallan realized that she'd naively been expecting Yasna to be an ugly spinster, like the stern matrons who had tutored her years ago. How else could one picture a heretic well into her mid-30s and still unmarried? Yasna was nothing like that. She was tall and slender, with clear skin, narrow black eyebrows, and thick, deep onyx hair. She wore part of it up, wrapped around a small, scroll-shaped golden ornament with 2 long hairpins holding it in place. The rest tumbled down behind her neck in small, tight curls. Even twisted and curled as it was, it came down to Yasna's shoulders. If left unbound, it would be as long as Shallan's hair, reaching past the middle of her back. She had a squarish face and discriminating pale violet eyes. She was listening to a man dressed in robes of burnt orange and white, the Carbranthian royal colors. Brightness Kolin was several fingers taller than the man. Apparently the Alethi reputation for height was no exaggeration. Yasna glanced at Shallan, noting her, then returned to her conversation. Stormfather, this woman was the sister of a king. Reserved, statuesque, dressed immaculately in blue and silver. Like Shallan's dress, Yasna's buttoned up the sides and had a high collar, though Yasna had a much fuller chest than Shallan. The skirts were loose below the waist, falling generously to the floor. Her sleeves were long and stately, and the left one was buttoned up to hide her safe hand. On her free hand was a distinctive piece of jewelry, 2 rings and a bracelet connected by several chains, holding a triangular group of gemstones across the back of the hand. A soul caster. The word was used for both the people who performed the process and the fabrial that made it possible. Shallan edged into the room, trying to get a better look at the large, glowing gemstones. Her heart began to beat a little faster. The soul caster looked identical to the one she and her brothers had found in the inside pocket of her father's coat. Yasna and the man in robes began walking in Shallan's direction, still talking. How would Yasna react, now that her ward had finally caught up to her? Would she be angry because of Shallan's tardiness? Shallan couldn't be blamed for that, but people often expect irrational things from their inferiors. Like the grand cavern outside, this hallway was cut from the rock, but it was more richly furbished, with ornate hanging chandeliers made with stormlit gemstones. Most were deep violet garnets, which were among the less valuable stones. Even so, the sheer number hanging there glistening with violet light would make the chandelier worth a small fortune. More than that, however, Shallan was impressed with the symmetry of the design and the beauty of the pattern of crystals hanging at the sides of the chandelier. As Yasna grew near, Shallan could hear some of what she was saying. "Realize that this action might prompt an unfavorable reaction from the devotaries," the woman said, speaking in Alethi. It was very near to Shallan's native Vaden, and she'd been taught to speak it well during her childhood.
"Yes, Brightness," said the robed man.
He was elderly, with a wispy white beard, and had pale gray eyes. His open, kindly face seemed very concerned, and he wore a squat cylindrical hat that matched the orange and white of his robes. Rich robes. Was this some kind of royal steward, perhaps? No. Those gemstones on his fingers, the way he carried himself, the way other light-eyed attendants deferred to him.
Stormfather, Shallan thought. This has to be the king himself. Not Yasna's brother, Elokar, but the king of Carbranth, Taravangian.
Shallan hastily performed an appropriate curtsy, which Yasna noted.
"The Ardents have much sway here, Your Majesty," Yasna said with a smooth voice.
"As do I," the king said. "You needn't worry about me."
"Very well," Yasna said. "Your terms are agreeable. Lead me to the location, and I shall see what can be done. If you will excuse me as we walk, however, I have someone to attend to."
Yasna made a curt motion toward Shallan, waving her to join them.
"Of course, Brightness," the king said.
He seemed to defer to Yasna. Carbranth was a very small kingdom, just a single city, while Alethkar was one of the world's most powerful. An Alethi princess might well outrank a Carbranthian king in real terms, however protocol would have it. Shallan hurried to catch up to Yasna, who walked a little behind the king as he began to speak to his attendants.
"Brightness," Shallan said, "I am Shallan Devar, whom you asked to meet you. I deeply regret not being able to get to you in Dumadari."
"The fault was not yours," Yasna said with a wave of the fingers. "I didn't expect that you would make it in time. I wasn't certain where I would be going after Dumadari when I sent you that note, however."
Yasna wasn't angry. That was a good sign. Shallan felt some of her anxiety recede.
"I am impressed by your tenacity, child," Yasna continued. "I honestly didn't expect you to follow me this far. After Carbranth, I was going to forego leaving you notes, as I'd presumed that you'd have given up. Most do so after the first few stops."
"Most? Then it was a test of some sort? And Shallan had passed?"
"Yes, indeed," Yasna continued, voice musing. "Perhaps I will actually allow you to petition me for a place as my ward."
Shallan almost stumbled in shock. "Petition her? Wasn't that what she'd already done?"
"Brightness," Shallan said. "I thought that... well, your letter..."
Yasna eyed her.
"I gave you leave to meet me, Miss Devar. I did not promise to take you on. The training and care of a ward is a distraction for which I have little tolerance or time at the present. But you have traveled far. I will entertain your request, though understand that my requirements are strict."
Shallan covered a grimace.
"No tantrum," Yasna noted. "That is a good sign."
"Tantrum, Brightness? From a light-eyed woman?"
"You'd be surprised," Yasna said dryly. "But attitude alone will not earn your place. Tell me, how extensive is your education?"
"Extensive in some areas," Shallan said. Then she hesitantly added, "extensively lacking in others."
"Very well," Yasna said. Ahead, the king seemed to be in a hurry, but he was old enough that even an urgent walk was still slow. "Then we shall do an evaluation. Answer truthfully and do not exaggerate, as I will soon discover your lies. Feign no false modesty either. I haven't the patience for a simperer."
"Yes, Brightness."
"We shall begin with music. How would you judge your skill?"
"I have a good ear, Brightness," Shallan said honestly. "I'm best with voice, though I have been trained on the zither and the pipes. I would be far from the best you'd heard, but I'd also be far from the worst. I know most historical ballads by heart."
Give me the refrain from Lilting Adrene. Here? I'm not fond of repeating myself, child. Shallan blushed, but began to sing. It wasn't her finest performance, but her tone was pure, and she didn't stumble over any of the words. Good, Yasna said, as Shallan paused for a breath. Languages? Shallan fumbled for a moment, bringing her attention away from frantically trying to remember the next verse. Languages? I can speak your native Alethi, obviously, Shallan said. I have a passable reading knowledge of Thalen and good spoken Azish. I can make myself understood in Salay, but not read it. Yasna made no comment either way. Shallan began to grow nervous. Writing? Yasna asked.
I know all of the major, minor, and topical glyphs and can paint them calligraphically.
So can most children.
The glyph words that I paint are regarded by those who know me as quite impressive.
Glyph words? Yasna said.
I had reason to believe you wanted to be a scholar, not a purveyor of superstitious nonsense.
I have kept a journal since I was a child, Shallan continued, in order to practice my writing skills.
Congratulations, Yasna said. Should I need someone to write a treatise on their stuffed pony or give an account of an interesting pebble they discovered, I shall send for you. Is there nothing you can offer that shows you have true skill?
Shallan blushed.
With all due respect, Brightness, you have a letter from me yourself, and it was persuasive enough to make you grant me this audience.
A valid point, Yasna said, nodding.
It took you long enough to make it. How is your training in logic and its related arts?
I'm accomplished in basic mathematics, Shallan said, still flustered, and I often helped with minor accounts for my father. I have read through the complete works of Tormas, Nashan, Niali the Just, and, of course, Noadon.
Placini?
Who?
No.
Gabrathin, Ustara, Manoline, Siasik, Shauka, daughter Hazweth?
Shallan cringed and shook her head again. That last name was obviously Shin. Did the Shin people even have logic masters? Did Yasna really expect her wards to have studied such obscure texts?
I see, Yasna said. Well, what of history?
History? Shallan shrank down even further. This is one of the areas where I'm obviously deficient, Brightness. My father was never able to find a suitable tutor for me. I read the history books he owned, which were the entire set of Barlesha Lan's topics, mostly.
Yasna waved her free hand dismissively.
Barely worth the time spent scribing them. A popular survey of historical events at best.
I apologize, Brightness.
This is an embarrassing hole. History is the most important of the literary sub-arts. One would think that your parents would have taken specific care in this area, if they'd hoped to submit you to study under a historian like myself.
My circumstances are unusual, Brightness.
Ignorance is hardly unusual, Miss Tavar.
The longer I live, the more I come to realize that it is the natural state of the human mind. There are many who will strive to defend its sanctity and then expect you to be impressed with their efforts.
Shallan blushed again. She'd realized she had some deficiencies, but Yasna had unreasonable expectations.
She said nothing, continuing to walk beside the taller woman. How long was this hallway, anyway? She was so flustered she didn't even look at the paintings they passed. They turned a corner, walking deeper into the mountainside.
Well, let us move on to science, then, Yasna said, tone displeased. What can you say of yourself there?
I have the reasonable foundation in the sciences you might expect of a young woman my age, Shallan said, more stiffly than she would have liked.
Which means?
I can speak with skill about geography, geology, physics, and chemistry. I've made particular study of biology and botany as I was able to pursue them with a reasonable level of independence on my father's estates. But if you expect me to be able to solve Faberson's conundrum with a wave of my hand, I suspect you shall be disappointed.
Have I not a right to make reasonable demands of my potential students, Miss DeVar?
Reasonable? Your demands are about as reasonable as the ones made of the 10 heralds on Proving Day. With all due respect, Brightness, you seem to want potential wards to be master scholars already. I may be able to find a pair of 80-year-old Ardens in the city who might fit your requirements. They could interview for the position, though they may have trouble hearing well enough to answer your questions.
I see, Yasna replied. And do you speak with such pique to your parents as well?
Shallan winced. Her time spent with the sailors had loosened her tongue far too much. Had she traveled all this way only to offend Yasna? She thought of her brothers, destitute, keeping up a tenuous facade back home. Would she have to return to them in defeat, having squandered this opportunity?
I did not speak to them this way, Brightness. Nor should I to you. I apologize.
Well, at least you are humble enough to admit fault. Still, I am disappointed. How is it that your mother considered you ready for a wardship?
My mother passed away when I was just a child, Brightness.
And your father soon remarried. Maliz Gevelmar, I believe.
Shallan started at her knowledge. House DeVar was ancient, but only of middling power and importance. The fact that Yasna knew the name of Shallan's stepmother said a lot about her.
My stepmother passed away recently. She didn't send me to be your ward. I took this initiative upon myself.
My condolences, Yasna said. Perhaps you should be with your father, seeing to his estates and comforting him, rather than wasting my time.
The men walking ahead turned down another side passage. Yasna and Shallan followed, entering a smaller corridor with an ornate red and yellow rug, mirrors hanging on the walls. Shallan turned to Yasna.
My father has no need of me.
Well, that was true.
But I have great need of you, as this interview itself has proven. If ignorance galls you so much, can you in good conscience pass up the opportunity to rid me of mine?
I've done so before, Miss DeVar. You're the 12th young woman to ask me for a wardship this year.
12? Shallan thought. In 1 year?
And she'd assumed that women would stay away from Jasna because of her antagonism toward the devotaries. The group reached the end of the narrow hallway, turning a corner to find, to Shallan's surprise, a place where a large chunk of rock had fallen from the ceiling. A dozen or so attendants stood here, some looking anxious. What was going on? Much of the rubble had evidently been cleared away, though the gouge in the ceiling gaped ominously. It didn't look out on the sky. They'd been progressing downward, and were probably far underground. A massive stone, taller than a man, had fallen into a doorway on the left. There was no getting past it into the room beyond. Shallan thought she heard sounds on the other side. The king stepped up to the stone, speaking in a comforting voice. He pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and wiped his aged brow.
The dangers of living in a building cut directly into the rock, Yasna said, striding forward.
When did this happen?
Apparently she hadn't been summoned to the city specifically for this purpose. The king was simply taking advantage of her presence.
During the recent high storm, Brightness, the king said.
He shook his head, making his drooping thin white mustache tremble.
The palace architects might be able to cut a way into the room, but it would take time, and the next high storm is scheduled to hit in just a few days. Beyond that, breaking in might bring down more of the ceiling.
I thought Carbranth was protected from the high storms, Your Majesty, Shallan said, causing Yasna to shoot her a glance.
The city is sheltered, young woman, the king said, but the stone mountain behind us is buffeted quite strongly. Sometimes it causes avalanches on that side, and that can cause the entire mountainside to shake.
He glanced at the ceiling.
Cave-ins are very rare, and we thought this area was quite safe, but...
But it is rock, Yasna said. And there is no telling if a weak vein lurks just beyond the surface. She inspected the monolith that had fallen from the ceiling. This will be difficult. I will probably lose a very valuable focal stone. The king began, wiping his brow again. If only we had a shard blade. Yasna cut him off with a wave of the hand. I was not seeking to renegotiate our bargain, Your Majesty. Access to the Palinaeum is worth the cost. You will want to send someone for wet rags. Have the majority of the servants move down to the other end of the hallway. You may wish to wait there yourself.
I will stay here, the king said, causing his attendants to object, including a large man wearing a black leather cuirass, probably his bodyguard. The king silenced them by raising his wrinkled hand. I will not hide like a coward when my granddaughter is trapped.
No wonder he was so anxious. Yasna didn't argue further, and Shallan could see from her eyes that it was of no consequence to her if the king risked his life. The same apparently went for Shallan, for Yasna didn't order her away. Servants approached with wetted cloths and distributed them. Yasna refused hers. The king and his bodyguard raised theirs to their faces, covering mouth and nose. Shallan took hers. What was the point of it? A couple of servants passed some wet cloths through a space between the rock and the wall to those inside. Then all of the servants rushed away down the hallway. Yasna picked and prodded at the boulder. Miss Devar, she said, what method would you use to ascertain the mass of this stone? Shallan blinked. Well, I suppose I'd ask His Majesty. His architects probably calculated it. Yasna cocked her head. An elegant response. Did they do that, Your Majesty?
Yes, Brightness Colin, the king said. It's roughly 15,000 cavals.
Yasna eyed Shallan.
A point in your favor, Miss Devar. A scholar knows not to waste time rediscovering information already known. It's a lesson I sometimes forget.
Shallan felt herself swell at the words. She already had an inkling that Yasna did not give such praise lightly. Did this mean that the woman was still considering her as a ward? Yasna held up her free hand, soulcaster glistening against the skin. Shallan felt her heartbeat speed up. She'd never seen soulcasting done in person. The Ardents were very secretive in using their fabrials, and she hadn't even known that her father had one until they'd found it on him. Of course, his no longer worked. That was one of the main reasons she was here. The gemstones set into Yasna's soulcaster were enormous, some of the largest that Shallan had ever seen, worth many spheres each. One was smokestone, a pure, glassy, black gemstone. The second was a diamond. The third was a ruby. All three were cut. A cut stone could hold more stormlight into glistening, many-faceted, oval shapes. Yasna closed her eyes, pressing her hand against the fallen boulder. She raised her head, inhaling slowly. The stones on the back of her hand began to glow more fiercely, the smokestone in particular growing so bright it was difficult to look at. Shallan held her breath. The only thing she dared do was blink, committing the scene to memory. For a long, extended moment, nothing happened. And then briefly, Shallan heard a sound. A low thrumming, like a distant group of voices, humming together a single pure note. Yasna's hand sank into the rock. The stone vanished. A burst of dense black smoke exploded into the hallway, enough to blind Shallan. It seemed the output of a thousand fires and smelled of burned wood. Shallan hastily raised the wet rag to her face, dropping to her knees. Oddly, her ears felt stopped up, as if she'd climbed down from a great height. She had to swallow to pop them. She shut her eyes tightly as they began to water, and she held her breath. Her ears filled with a rushing sound. It passed.
She blinked open her eyes to find the king and his bodyguard huddled against the wall beside her. Smoke still pooled at the ceiling. The hallway smelled strongly of it. Yasna stood, eyes still closed, oblivious of the smoke, though grime now dusted her face and clothing. It had left marks on the walls, too. Shallan had read of this, but she was still in awe. Yasna had transformed the boulder into smoke, and since smoke was far less dense than stone, the change had pushed the smoke away in an explosive outburst. It was true. Yasna really did have a functioning soulcaster, and a powerful one, too. 9 out of 10 soulcasters were capable of a few limited transformations, creating water or grain from stone, forming bland, single-roomed rock buildings out of air or cloth. A greater one like Yasna's could effectuate any transformation, literally turn any substance into any other one. How it must grate on the Ardents that such a powerful holy relic was in the hands of someone outside the Ardentia, and a heretic, no less. Shallan stumbled to her feet, leaving the cloth at her mouth, breathing humid but dust-free air. She swallowed, her ears popping again as the hall's pressure returned to normal. A moment later, the king rushed into the now accessible room. A small girl, along with several nursemaids and other palace servants, sat on the other side, coughing. The king pulled the girl into his arms. She was too young to have a modesty sleeve. Yasna opened her eyes, blinking, as if momentarily confused by her location. She took a deep breath and didn't cough. Indeed, she actually smiled, as if enjoying the scent of the smoke. Yasna turned to Shallan, focusing on her. You are still waiting for a response. I'm afraid you will not like what I say. But you haven't finished your testing of me yet, Shallan said, forcing herself to be bold. Surely you won't give judgment until you have.